Geekscape.com.
The Bizarre Story of Kristallnacht by Ingrid Veckart. Kristallnacht is the name that's been given to the night of the 9th to the 10th of November 1938. In almost all large German cities, and some smaller ones that night, store windows of Jewish shops were broken. Jewish houses and apartments were destroyed, and synagogues were demolished and set on fire. Many Jews were arrested, some were beaten, and some were even killed. The Reich Kristallnacht was one of the most shameful events of National Socialist Germany. Although the Jews suffered initially, the greatest harm was ultimately done to Germany and the German people. Even people who are sympathetic to National Socialism cannot understand how this event could have happened. Julius Streicher, the so-called number one Jew-baiter, for example, was shocked when he first learned about the demonstrations and destruction the next morning. The all-important question is, who was responsible for the incident? It is generally accepted, especially by contemporary historians, that the Nazi gang organized and carried out the pogrom, and that the chief instigator was propaganda minister Dr. Joseph Goebbels. The truth of the matter is that Adolf Hitler was so disgusted by the incident that he forbade anyone from discussing the matter in his presence. Dr. Goebbels complained that he would now have to explain this terrible affair to the German people and the world, and that he simply did not know what kind of credible explanation to give. If he had actually been responsible for the Kristallnacht, he surely would have had a well-prepared explanation. The explanation he gave on the morning of the 10th was extremely unconvincing and was generally not believed by the German public. During my study of this subject, which resulted in my book on the Kristallnacht, Fürsicken, I found many facts which do not agree with the generally accepted thesis. On the contrary, the evidence which I have found gives a completely different picture. The generally accepted sequence of events, according to most writers on the subject, is this. In early October 1938, the Polish government announced that all Polish passports would become invalid at the end of the month unless they received a special stamp before then, obtainable only in Poland. This measure was meant to rid Poland, effectively for all time, of all Polish Jews living in foreign countries, most of whom were in Germany. Many of the approximately 70,000 Polish Jews living in the Reich at the time had arrived after the First World War. Of course, the German government now feared that it would have to permanently accept these 70,000 Jews. The German government tried to negotiate this issue with the Poles, but they flatly refused. On the 28th of October, just 2 days before the deadline, German police rounded up between 15,000 and 17,000 Polish Jews, mostly adult males, from across the Reich, and transported them to the German-Polish border. The deportees travelled in regular German passenger trains with more than adequate space. Contrary to some claims, they were not crammed into cattle cars. The deportees were well provided with food and medical care. Red Cross personnel and medical doctors accompanied them on the trains. The Polish border officials were surprised when the first trainloads arrived at the border, and they let the Jews enter Poland. At about the same time, the Polish government was deporting German Jews back to Germany. The next day, on the 29th of October, the Polish and German governments suddenly agreed to stop the deportations of their respective Jewish populations to each other's countries. The deportations were completely halted that night. Among the Polish Jews deported was the family of Herschel Feibel Greenspan, a 17-year-old, then living in Paris. What followed next is generally reported either incorrectly or very one-sidedly. On the 7th of November, Greenspan went to the German embassy in Paris and shot embassy secretary Ernst von Rath. It is said that Greenspan did this because he was furious over the deportation of his family. But the truth about his motivation is very different. It is also claimed that the German population, upset by the news of von Rath's death on the 9th, organized anti-Jewish demonstrations, destroyed Jewish stores, and demolished or set on fire all the synagogues in Germany. Demonstrations and destruction did take place, but the truth is that they were not organized by the German people and did not affect most of the synagogues in the Reich. Finally, it is claimed that the Kristallnacht was the beginning of the extermination of the Jews in Germany. And this, of course, is entirely false. Before explaining how the events surrounding the Kristallnacht differ from what is generally believed, I must first give some background information about the peaceful years in Germany after Hitler came to power in 1933. Anyone who is aware of the true situation in Germany during the Third Reich era recognizes that the Kristallnacht episode was quite extraordinary. It was a radical aberration from the normal pattern of daily life. The outburst was not in keeping with either the official National Socialist Jewish policy, nor with the general German attitude towards the Jews. The Germans were no more anti-Semitic than any other people. In fact, Jews who had to leave other European countries preferred Germany as a place to live and work. Within the National Socialist Party itself, there were two distinct anti-Semitic factions. One was scholarly and one was vulgar. The scholarly faction was centered around the Institute for the Study of the Jewish Question. It published several journals and gave lectures to civic and political groups. Its activities were consistent with the policy of peacefully removing the Jews from Germany and resettling them elsewhere. The SS was totally committed to this policy and rejected vulgar anti-Semitism. The vulgar anti-Semitic faction tried to influence popular feeling. The chief exponent of this approach was Julius Streicher, who published the unofficial monthly Der Stürmer. It used crude caricatures to portray Jews in the most horrible way, in an effort to convince readers that the Jews were as evil as Satan. For years, the motto, "The Jews are our misfortune," appeared on the front page of every issue. The Stürmer often employed improper and undignified means to make its point. German National Socialism basically regarded the Jews as non-German aliens who had proven themselves destructive to any nation that permitted them to dominate. Therefore, the only way to prevent further problems was to separate the Jews from the Germans. In other words, they had to emigrate. On this point, the National Socialists and the Zionists were in full agreement. Although the Jews made up less than 1% of the total German population in 1933, they had power and influence in finance, business, cultural affairs, and scientific life, far out of proportion to their small numbers. Jewish influence was very widely regarded as harmful to German recovery after the First World War. No legal measures were taken against the Jews in Germany until after the International Jewish Declaration of War against Germany, as announced, for example, on the front page of the London Daily Express of the 24th of March, 1933. This declaration took the form of a worldwide boycott of German goods. A week later, there was an officially sanctioned boycott of Jewish shops and stores throughout Germany. This action was in direct response to the international Jewish boycott of German goods, already in effect. However, the German response was a rather absurd affair, and it was therefore limited to a single day, the 1st of April, 1933. Hitler and Goebbels privately recognized that the German counter-boycott was a failure and would only turn people against the new government. Furthermore, this one-day action came on a Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath. Religious Jews took malicious pleasure at the discomfort of the Jews who normally kept their stores open on Saturdays and were now, in effect, forced by the government to obey the Jewish law against work on the Sabbath. The National Socialist regime, thereafter, sought to diminish Jewish influence and power by strictly legal means. The first German law which could be considered anti-Jewish was dated the 7th of April, 1933. Although the legal status of the Jews was restricted, each and every Jew knew what his legal rights were and to what he was still entitled. There were no secret or extra-legal measures against the Jews. Ironically, it was precisely the official discrimination policy against the Jews which reduced the effectiveness of anti-Semitic propaganda to almost nothing. The Germans are a generally fair-minded people. When Germans saw their Jewish neighbours being treated unjustly, they considered that far worse than the dangers which the Jews supposedly represented simply because they were Jewish. They considered that far worse than the dangers which the Jews supposedly represented simply because they were Jewish. Furthermore, the examples of Jewish criminality and perversion described in the Stürmer were widely regarded as exceptions to normal Jewish behaviour. The average German was convinced that the Jews whom he knew personally were completely unlike the criminal types sometimes described in newspapers. In my hometown of Berlin, most of the doctors and lawyers were still Jewish, and even the public health officer for children in the district of Berlin where my family lived was a Jew who kept his job throughout the war. I still remember one day when my mother returned from her Jewish doctor. She told us that she hadn't been able to see him because he was no longer there. He had been taken away, hauled off the previous night. My mother was very upset. A crowd of people had gathered outside his house. They were all shocked, and they discussed the injustice of this measure quite openly. My parents later talked about what had happened, and they both agreed that the doctor had never really done anything wrong. And their reaction was typical. A few days later, our family pediatrician, who is also Jewish, was likewise taken away. At the time, I did not know what it meant to be taken away. It was only many years after the war, when I started reading the Holocaust literature, that I learned that I was supposed to believe that to be taken away meant deportation to a concentration camp and probably death. But like so many thousands of others, these two family doctors were not exterminated. One summer day in 1973, as I was walking through the streets of the German Quarter in Tel Aviv, I came upon the nameplates of both doctors on the doors of two houses. I immediately tried to visit them and found out that both families had migrated to Palestine in 1939. Although one of them had died in the meantime, in Israel, I was able to speak to the other. He remembered my father very well and explained that when he and his family were arrested, they were taken to a camp and given the choice of either signing a document declaring their intention of emigrating from Germany or being taken to a labor camp. He and his family chose to emigrate. In fact, most German Jews survived the anti-Semitic measures quite well. That does not mean that those measures were not unfair to individual Jews, but they could usually manage to live with them. As already mentioned, the main goal of Germany's Jewish policy was to encourage the Jews to emigrate. After the beginning of the international Jewish boycott against German goods in March 1933, The Jewish community in Palestine contacted the German government and offered a break in the boycott as far as Palestine was concerned, provided it was combined with a Jewish emigration from Germany. As a result, the Havara, or transfer, agreement was signed by the Germans and the Jews in May 1933. The Jewish community thus concluded an extremely beneficial agreement with the National Socialist government only a few months after its formation. This agreement was a crucial phase in the creation of the State of Israel. When I made this claim in my book, which appeared in 1981, some readers considered it outrageous. But then this same claim was made in The Transfer Agreement, a book by Edwin Black, published in 1984. The final paragraph of his book concludes with the statement that the continuing economic relationship between the Jewish community of Palestine and National Socialist Germany was, quote, an indispensable factor in the creation of the State of Israel, close quote. The Havara Agreement made it possible for any Jew to emigrate from Germany with practically all of his possessions and personal fortune, provided that Jews could deposit all of their assets in one of two Jewish-owned banks in Germany, which had branch offices in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Upon arrival in Palestine, they could withdraw their assets according to the terms of the agreement. The German capital of these two Jewish banking firms was guaranteed by the German government. Even after the war, these assets were fully available to the Jewish owners or their representatives. If a Jew did not wish to emigrate immediately, he could transfer all of his personal assets to Palestine, where they would be safeguarded by a trustee while he remained in Germany for an indefinite period, with emigration as his eventual goal. In the meantime, his personal fortune was safe outside of Germany. Even poorer Jews, who did not possess 1,000 English pounds, were able to emigrate to Palestine with credits provided through the Havara. The British authorities generally required minimum assets of 1,000 pounds for each immigrant to Palestine, if he was not entitled to a so-called worker's certificate. Only a limited number of these certificates were available, and they were issued only to persons with special job skills. In addition, Jews emigrating to Palestine were exempt from the so-called Reich flight tax, which all emigrating Germans normally had to pay. However, the Jewish companies which arranged the transfers charged the emigrants a fixed percentage of their total assets. The Havara Agreement remained in operation until the end of 1941, when the United States entered the war. I am always amazed when I read books about the Third Reich published after the war. Most give an almost totally false impression of the reality of the Third Reich. The Germany of Adolf Hitler was not the Germany described by such books. It was quite different. I was brought up during the Third Reich. Along with my entire generation, I received an education of the highest ethical standards. We were brought up to love and respect our country and people. We were taught to be proud of its great history. The heroes of Germany's past represented our great ideals. They spurred us to honesty and responsibility in our own lives. In my opinion, the youth of Adolf Hitler's Germany was the finest of all Europe, and perhaps of the entire world. The same ethical standards applied to the SS and SA. The SA stormtroopers were not sophisticated men. They usually preferred to use their fists before using their heads, but they acted according to the ideals which they had been taught: honour, faithfulness, honesty, and devotion to their people and country. They were not at all the sadistic beasts portrayed by so-called historians. It was their faithfulness and gallantry which saved Germany from chaos and communism. It is sheer stupidity to describe the SA men as bloodthirsty killers, as is widely done today. Although some individual SA men may have committed acts of brutality, it is nonsense to blame the entire organisation or the whole German people and its government for such behaviour. Individual SA men were indeed involved in the Kristallnacht incident, but far fewer actually participated than has been claimed. Of the 28 SA groups which existed in Germany at the time, the only available evidence identifies only three as having actually received orders to join the anti-Jewish demonstrations. Now let us look at what really happened during that fateful night. After 1945, any harm ever done to any Jew in National Socialist Germany has been described in great detail in many publications and combined with other stories to give exaggerated figures, which have then become the so-called historical truth. How strange it is, then, that despite the passage of more than 40 years, no one has established the true extent of the damage done to the Jews during the Kristallnacht. All one can learn from history writers is that all synagogues were demolished and that all shop windows were destroyed. Aside from this vague description, one is given almost no details. On the basis of the so-called historical truth about the Kristallnacht, the president of the World Jewish Congress, Nahum Goldmann, had the chutzpah in 1952 to claim $500 million from German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer as a reparation payment for the damage done during that November night. When Adenauer asked Goldmann for his justification for this enormous request, Goldmann replied, quote, "You find the justification yourself. What I want is not the justification, but the money." Close quote. And he got his money. Goldmann may have interpreted the willingness of the German Chancellor to pay $500 million as proof for the claim that all synagogues had been destroyed. Why else would Germany be so foolish as to pay for something which never happened? All the same, the historical truth that all German synagogues were destroyed is a lie. In 1938, there were approximately 1,400 synagogues in Germany, of which only about 180 were destroyed or damaged. Furthermore, Jews owned approximately 100,000 shops and department stores in Germany in 1938. Of this number, only about 7,500 had their windows broken. These figures show just how much the so-called historical truth differs from what actually happened. The damage and destruction that did actually occur was, of course, a terrible shame, but the exaggerations, especially by German historians, who use them to condemn their own people, are also a shame. History writers tell us that during the Kristallnacht, all the Jews were frightened, meekly accepted whatever happened to them, and watched the destruction of their property with no resistance. The contrary is true. While going through the files on this subject, I found many documents which report precisely just the opposite of what is claimed. The fact is that in many cases, Jews and their German neighbours fought together against the attackers, pushing them down staircases. Street mobs were beaten up and chased away in more than one case. Police and party officials were generally on the side of the Jews. Some Jewish community leaders went to police stations the next morning and asked the police to investigate the damage done to their synagogues. The resulting police reports are still available in the files today. Also, contrary to what we have been told, most Jews were not directly affected by these events. In Berlin, for example, all of the teachers and pupils of the city's largest Jewish school, which served the entire Berlin area, appeared in their classes the next morning without having noticed anything unusual during the previous night. Heinemann Stern, the Jewish principal of that school, wrote in his post-war memoirs that he noticed a burning synagogue on his way to the school on the morning after the Kristallnacht, but he thought it was just an accidental fire. It was only after he arrived at the school that he received a telephone call informing him of the destruction of the previous night. He then went on with the classes of the day, and only during the first recess did he take the trouble to inform the entire student body about what had happened. How can such evidence be reconciled with the claim by Hermann Gramel, a prominent German historian and associate of the Munich Institute of Contemporary History, who wrote, quote, "Every single Jew was beaten, chased, robbed, insulted, and humiliated. The SA tore the Jews from their beds, mercilessly beat them in their apartments, and then chased them almost to death. Blood flowed everywhere." Close quote. Is it conceivable that thousands of Jewish children would have been sent to school by their parents on the morning after that fateful night if the attacks against Jews had been so horrific or extensive? Would any parents have let their children go to school if they had thought there was even the slightest chance of them being attacked by roving gangs of SA men? I think the answer is clearly no. Deplorable things did indeed happen, which were bad enough, but the fantasies of modern historians and history writers, such as Gramel, are simply inexcusable.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.